This is When Orla Met, a conversation with and about some of the leading athletes, inspiring characters and most engaging brains in sport. A huge thank you to Twist Teas for supporting this podcast. I've been loving their proper mint blend lately, which I find takes the edge off rather nicely after a heavy, sunny barbecue. Twist Teas have a wonderful selection of blends with a twist to choose from, so brew yourself a cuppa and enjoy When Orla Met Judy Murray. Today's guest is someone I have fangirled over for a long time now. Judy Murray was pilloried by the press for many years for being this pushy tennis mum to her two precociously talented children, Jamie and Andy Murray. That image has softened somewhat over the last couple of years, helped at least in part by a successful stint on the TV show Strictly Come Dancing. But many still don't realise the level of sacrifice that Judy made to give her sons the best start in life, running up huge financial debt to send them to training bases in Barcelona and Paris when they outgrew opportunities at home, constantly fighting a reluctant system as Scottish national coach, and learning to protect and nurture both her boys, but arguably more so Jamie, who still doesn't receive the attention, column inches, sponsorship of his younger brother, despite both being at various times world number ones and Grand Slam champions. Well, Judy has just released the paperback version of her rather wonderful memoir, and it's for this reason I've come along to chat to her. This is part one of When Orla Met Judy Murray. So Judy, thank you for taking the time to chat to me. You've had a busy all day, haven't you? What have you been up to?
I've been doing a photo shoot for You magazine, and it's one of the sort of pre-publication PR things for the paperback edition of my book that's coming out in May. So I was doing that. So it's not something that I do very regularly, and any time that I have done them, it always amazes me how many people you need to make something like that happen. Because it's like so many things, you know, you'd look at a feature in a magazine and you'd read it and you'd look at the pictures and you wouldn't for 1 minute think about everything that went into making that article or that feature or that photograph happen. So it always amazes me just how many people are around to make a day like that go ahead.
Is that something that you're comfortable with these days, posing in front of the camera and putting yourself on display in that very public way?
I don't do it very often, and I'm always fascinated to do something that's different, that's something that's away from my normal way of work, which is usually on a tennis court with a tracksuit and loads of kids. But I'm probably a little bit more used to doing it now. I think actually since I did Strictly, mm-hmm. such a big part of Strictly, all the sort of the media that went around the show, I kind of got a little bit of a taste of it then. But I only do it once in a while, that suits me just fine.
What about Strictly then, and that whole period, I guess, of your very public career? How have you found it looks like you've adjusted to being in the public eye quite a bit. Are you more comfortable with it now than you were before, do you think?
It was actually the first time that I'd done something for myself for years and years and years, and I absolutely loved it. I think for me it was, in many ways, it was a really good thing for me, in that I think it allowed so much of the public who watched the show to see that I wasn't just that, you know, serious competitive mum that sits in the player box stressing over their kids at Wimbledon, you know, that it kind of allowed me to show my personality, and they saw me having fun and having a go, you know what I mean, to do something like that when you're 55 and learn a brand new skill and be prepared to do it badly on national TV on a Saturday night was something else. And yeah, I think it probably let people see the normal side of me, not the stressed parent at the Grand Slam side of me.
So you've written an autobiography, the hardback version was out last year and the paperback about to come out, as you say. What's that experience like? I always imagine it must be quite bizarre looking on your life almost as an outsider and giving significance to certain events. Mm. How was that whole process for you?
I'd say it's probably more of a memoir than an autobiography, in that it's the memoir of my family's tennis story and probably everything that I had to experience as a parent, a coach. You know, I learned how to coach and as a woman in a ultimately what is a man's sporting world. But I wrote it with a proper author called Alexandra Hemingsley. And so we started it just after Wimbledon 2016 and finished it in November 2016, just after the boys ended up as year-end world number ones in singles and doubles. Like, the timing was just absolutely perfect. It couldn't have been better. And then it made me think of all sorts of episodes in my life that I probably had parked or kind of forgotten about, you know, somewhere along the line. But she made it very easy for me, you know, because she turned it into a story. I could probably, left to my own devices, have written a pretty boring chronological account of it all. But she turned it into a story because she's a proper writer, and she was great fun to work with.
So what kind of experiences then did it throw up and throw a light on that you might otherwise have forgotten about or maybe not afforded much significance to?
I started the book talking about sort of my experiences growing up as a child of sporty parents, which of course is what my kids were as well, and the fact that, you know, in Scotland tennis was very much a minority sport and very few people played it. Very bad weather, so you play tennis in the summer, you play badminton in the winter, and you learned how to play by playing with your parents and other people at your tennis club. There was no coaching, there was no formal structure, no infrastructure, no track record of success, anything like that. So in my day, there were very few opportunities. And I think that when I started to talk about that sort of side of it and how frustrating that was when you got to sort of 17 and you're leaving school and you're one of the best juniors in Britain, you're not brilliant, but you're one of the best and you don't get a chance to take it any further. And I think, I became aware when I was talking about that, you know, how much that lack of opportunity for me had driven me many years later when I got the chance to be the Scottish national coach to provide opportunities for Scottish kids. Why shouldn't we be able to play abroad? Why shouldn't we have a coaching programme? Why shouldn't we have structure, etc., etc.? But I think it reminded me, because we went through it more or less chronologically, I remembered most things, but there were a lot of things that I hadn't thought about for such a long time. And, you know, some of them were tough to talk about. And but I think, you know, by the time we finished it, I felt good about talking to somebody about it. And when I read the book, or when I started to edit it, it was like, I think I realise how much I must have wanted to tell the backstory of how the boys got to where they got to, because I think, like many things, people see the performance, they see the end result, but they never think about everything that's gone into making that happen. And I think that also because for so many years I'd been smashed up a lot in the media as the pushy mum, the competitive mum that's sort of pushed them all the way, and basically that I've brought them up to be tennis players. And nothing could be further from the truth. And I think I really wanted to tell people this is how it was. I mean, these are just two little brothers from a small town in the middle of Scotland, and they've gone on to be Grand Slam champions and world number ones. But actually, we've had to learn every step of the way because there was nobody to help us. There was very little support and encouragement, and it's been a battle. It's been a real battle. So And what I've also enjoyed a lot is the opportunity to talk the story, you know, with all the book PR, you know, all the book festivals that you do or bookseller events. And I've enjoyed that, the talking it to an audience, much more than I ever imagined that I would. And it's been amazing how many people have come to these events to ask questions because they're interested. And I hope that it's a inspirational story for parents, for mums out there, for women, I hope it makes people realise that, you know, it's not about what you have, it's what you do with what you have. And you know, if you work hard, you put your mind to it, you create opportunities, you never know where you might end up. Because when my kids first picked up a little bat with a swing ball in the back garden, I would never for a minute have imagined they'd end up doing what they're currently doing.
I think inspirational is exactly how I would describe the book and your life story as a woman, as a mother. And one of the things at the start of the book, it says that you're the ultimate role model for self-belief. Is that something that you feel that you embody, or is that something that you've had to learn along the way?
Definitely something that I've had to learn. I think I'm not so sure that that for me it was ever about self-belief. I think it was more about really a determination to make a difference and to create opportunities for, firstly, our club. That's how I started, as a volunteer at our local club when my kids were sort of in nappies. And I really went over to rejoin the club and discovered there were still no coaches there, and got involved with some of the older juniors and trying to teach them how to play. I wasn't a coach, but I played the game well, so I taught them in the same way that my parents had taught me, and it kind of snowballed from there. I found that, obviously, I've always loved tennis, but I loved teaching it. But for me, it was almost like it was all about creating opportunities. And actually, as I went through different qualifications and trying to improve and learning, you know, understanding that if I invested in myself, I was then investing in the players that we had, firstly at the club, then in the region, and then nationally. And one thing just kind of led to another, but it was really about learning every single step of the way. What's the next step? What do I need to do now? And, you know, whether that was learning to run competitions, or learning the next coaching qualification, or doing a PR course or a massage course, or learning how to do a tax return in Australia, or, you know, whatever it is, different things came in at different stages, and we just had to react to it. But, you know, I would say I had no idea where we were going with it. Just had this, it was such a huge adventure. And, you know, as the kids that I was working with kept improving and started to win national and international titles, you realise you're responsible for what's the next step. And, you know, there wasn't anybody to learn from in Scotland because nobody else had done it before. And So it was really up to me. But I'm very bloody minded, and you know, if people tell me I can't do something, or they say no, or don't be stupid, or whatever, I immediately want to prove them wrong. And you know, I'm very driven and very committed, and I just stuck with it. And you know, at the end of the day, my kids came through to a great level, but the opportunities were created for them. It's up to them to take it, and they've worked incredibly hard. And so I think they're a great example of, you know, anything's possible.
You mentioned your bloody-mindedness, and it's one of the character traits, I think, that you're probably most admired for as much as anything else. Where did that drive as a parent come from, or is that just something that's innate in you?
Yeah, I think I was always, you know, when I was young, I was always very competitive in anything that I did, particularly obviously in the sports that I did. I was competitive at school, as in I always wanted to do well in exams and so forth. My dad is very competitive, so perhaps I got that from him, but I don't know. I mean, I've always been a big believer that we are all products of our environment, so I'm guessing of my two parents, I would have said I'm probably much more like my father in that respect. But I don't think he's as bloody-minded as I am. I'm not sure I'd wish that, my bloody-mindedness, on anybody. But it is up to you as the parent to create the opportunities for your kids, you know, and it's opportunities in all sorts of things, you know, to grow educationally, socially, athletically, sensitively, etc. And I think I realised a lot more about what my parents did for me when I had my own children, things that you don't think about when you're young. Your parents are just there and they do it for you. But, you know, I realised how lucky I was to have sporty parents, to have parents who recognised an opportunity to send me to a girls' school where there would be a lot more sporting opportunities because that was what I enjoyed doing. And that was quite a big commitment for them financially. And I wouldn't have realised that at the time when I was 10 or 11 or probably through all of my school years. But I think, on this whole journey with the tennis, once the boys had decided that that was what they wanted to do, it was about trying to find, right, okay, well, what's next? So, of course, it's very easy to outgrow the opportunities in your own backyard, and then obviously very easy to outgrow it in Scotland because we didn't have an international training environment far from it. And so, you know, finding Andy a place to train in Barcelona and then trying to find the finance to make it happen was probably at that point that I thought, this is, you know, it's like sending them to an expensive boarding school. And it wasn't like we had loads of money. So you then have to try to, well, this is what he wants to do. He is one of the best in Europe. And I'm going to have to find a way to find the money to make it happen. And anyway, you know, it was a challenge. It was a real challenge, but I've always enjoyed a challenge. I am definitely one of those people that doesn't see a barrier. It just see something to get over or around or under, or, you know, find a way. It's a bit like playing a tennis match. You have to find a way to beat the guy on the or the girl on the other side of the court. You don't have to play your best every day, but you have to find a way. And that's not just about physically how you play, it's about mentally how you tackle it. So I think it probably helped that I had been a decent competitive tennis player, but the tennis world in my day was very different from the world that Jamie and Andy went into when they were sort of 12, 13, 14 and so on, completely different. So it didn't really help me then that I had played a bit. It helped them when they were younger because they immediately had somebody from a very young age who would play tennis with them anytime they wanted to and could put the ball anywhere they needed. So, I think, you know, there's lots of examples in the book of challenges, you know, where people made it difficult for us, people who could have helped us and chose not to because they didn't believe or they didn't think tennis was the right thing to, you know, to spend money on in Scotland. You know, other sports were more important, and everything was a challenge. And I think that when I was a Scottish national coach, you know, whenever people put me down or refused to help, I never knew how much of that was because I was a woman or because tennis was just something, we don't really do that in Scotland, you know, don't be silly, run along, or how much was because I was a parent of two of the kids that were part of the programme. I never knew the answers to any of those things, but I just knew that this is a whole lot harder than I thought. You know, that if somebody gives you the job of being the national coach for tennis, i.e. Sport Scotland, why aren't they supporting you when your kids in your programme are suddenly starting to win national and international titles, and you need more funding and you need more support and you need all sorts of things. And I never really understood that. And of course now, you know, once they start to break through, everybody wants to be your friend and everybody wants a bit of you. But I'm quite good at not letting people forget that they didn't help when I needed them to.
Before we continue, I want to take a quick tea break to say a huge thanks to Twist Teas for supporting this podcast, because there's nothing like a chat and a cup of tea to lift the spirits. Twist Teas have a range of 24 different blends with or without caffeine. So whether you're looking for a morning pick-me-up or an afternoon soother, you're bound to find a tea to suit. You can pick from their classic blend to peppermint with a hint of chocolate or functional herbs to give you a boost. Have a look. There really is a blend to suit pretty much every mood, or you could suggest blends of your own. Go to their website, twist-teas.co.uk.
And you mentioned you know, you're a coach and parent, but wearing just your parent's hat, for example, you say when Andy was second or third in Europe and needing the funding to send him to Spain, but even to get that far required an awful lot of financial sacrifice. And it wasn't just Andy, it was Jamie as well. Did you ever think to yourself, okay, they're talented, but you know what? we can't afford this sport as a family? Or what drove you? It seems logical now because you are the mother of two world number ones, Grand Slam champions, but at the time you didn't know what they would become. What was the driver then? Did you ever doubt yourself, or did you just think we've got to try to find a way to see this through?
Yeah, I think it was more I've got to try and find a way to do it. I think that, you know, for me, a big part of it was that, you know, they were involved in a sport that I loved. I was learning all the time. For me, it was an adventure for the most part. The stressful years were the years when Andy went to Barcelona, and then, you know, a year and a half after that, Jamie finished school and he decided that instead of going to an American university, which we thought he was going to, which would have been sort of all expenses paid scholarship, he decided he wanted to do what Andy was doing. But because he plays tennis so completely differently from Andy, he needed a completely different type of training environment. You know, it's not a one size fits all. And you can't give one child the chance and not give the other the chance. It's not possible. So I suddenly had a double challenge, and that was really the toughest time financially, and a real challenge to keep writing letters, to keep picking up phones, to keep creating presentations, and actually finding the money from, you know, a mixture of Tennis Scotland, Sport Scotland, the LTA, family members, your own work, bits and pieces of little local charities or sponsors who are involved in tennis that might give you £1,000 here or there. So all small amounts. It's very, very difficult to persuade people to invest in potential, particularly in an individual sport, you know, because there's no payback. It's all risk. So you will just get little pockets of money. So it was a lot of work trying to put all that together, and then obviously still having to work at the same time to put your own share into it. But anyway, we managed to get there, and I think very fortunate that in 2004, when Andy won the US Open Juniors, and he was a year young, if that makes sense, that means he could have played in juniors the following year also. It was statistically, it was a very good sign that boys who win Grand Slams a year young often go on to make the top 100. But it was I think there was, without me knowing for sure, I could tell by the way he played. He was so tactically astute. He's such a great athlete, and he was, you know, very driven, very competitive. And by that time he had also beaten his first top 100 player and won his first men's futures event, and these were all good signs. And so really, after he won US Open Juniors and just after that, when I presented to Sport Scotland the fact that we'd won a junior Grand Slam, and the guy I was presenting to said, yeah, but we're not interested in junior Grand Slams, we're interested in Grand Slams. And I just looked at him and thought, cart, horse. And I thought two other words as well, and I better not say them on the podcast. But
and I just, we can thought, guess.
Nobody's ever going to believe in me. We've just won a junior Grand Slam. And I just thought, you know what? If I can't rely on anybody else here, I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to have to find a way. And I had to believe that Andy winning the US Open Juniors a year young was going to open some doors for sponsorship at some point. And so I handed in my notice as national coach and had a three-month period. So I finished in the January, and it was just such a stressful time, because I knew I was going to have no income, and I was still going to be having to pay for training fees and competition costs and coach costs and all the rest of it. But I just knew that it was the right thing to do, because, you know, when kids are that age, they need somebody to manage everything for them so they can just concentrate on the tennis. They can't employ coaches, they can't do tax returns, they can't write sponsor letters and all the rest of it. So I did it, but that was without question, that whole run through Barcelona and Paris for Jamie. But it was very fortunate, because in June 2005 was when Andy got a wild card into Queens. He won he won a couple of matches there on the ATP tour, which meant he got some prize money. He started to move up the men's rankings. He got a wild card into Wimbledon. He made the third round. He lost in five sets to David Nalbandian, who was the world number four. And I went, this is unbelievable. He's just like, I mean, 12 months after winning the US Open Juniors 2004, he was 64 in the world and he was playing Federer in the final of the ATP event in Thailand. And it was fortunate that he went so fast, because financially it solved not all the problems, because we invested everything that he earned. We invested into a better coach, part-time fitness trainer. Everything was about investing to get better and better. But what it did was it freed up any money that I was earning for Jamie. And, you know, a couple of years later, Jamie caught up and the two of them are playing on the ATP tour together. So, but you don't know what you're getting into. You absolutely don't. And you have to believe you're doing the right thing. And the only thing I ever insisted with my kids was that they tried their hardest. And I think because they knew that it was a challenge financially to make it all happen, that they always tried their hardest, and they still do.
You mentioned the US Open Juniors and Andy winning there, and that eventually the money was your money was able to be freed up to help Jamie. And when he won in America, then Jamie got some of the reflected attention, if you like, and people asking him all about his younger brother and his success. How did you, as a parent, how do you manage that? How do you buoy up your other son who's still competing, who still has enormous talent, and who doesn't want to be overshadowed by his younger brother, but at the same time is incredibly proud of him?
Yeah, I think the toughest time with that was actually in 2006, early 2006, and Andy was playing in San Jose, and he was coached by a guy called Mark Petchy at the time, and it was actually school holiday week, and Mark Petchy was on holiday with his family. That had all been agreed, and Andy went to San Jose on his own with another player called James Auckland to play doubles. James Auckland, quite a bit older than Andy, and so he was over there on his own, and he made the final, and he won the final, and he beat Leighton Hewitt in the final. It was a huge, huge thing. He was 18 years old, and he was by himself without a coach. Kim was actually with him, who was his girlfriend by that time, just of maybe 6 months or so. And he'd just gone off and done it. He'd gone off and done it on his own at 18. You know, it's this whole thing of never having had the spoon feeding that many kids have nowadays. He was able to go and do that. And at the same time that he was playing in the final against Hewitt with the time difference, Jamie and me were in Sheffield, and Jamie was in the final of a Futures, which is the lowest rung of the men's tour for, you know, players maybe ranked between 600 and 1200. But it was a big thing for Jamie to be in the final of this, and we were in a travel lodge or something in Sheffield, and put the phone off and went to sleep, woke up the next morning, switched the phone on, and discovered that Andy had won in San Jose. And of course we're all very excited and all the rest of it, and but I'm thinking, right, okay, don't get too carried away, but give Andy a call. And actually this is about Jamie. He's got his match, and so we have a breakfast, we go to the indoor centre where this final is on, and there are all these vans outside, you know, satellite TV vans. And I said, that's really unusual for this kind of level of event, you know, you get one man and his dog watching it. And I thought, that's really strange, I wonder what they're here for. And we got in, and Jamie was going to practice, and they're setting up these cameras and things on the courts, and so I said to the referee, I said, final being televised or something? And he said, oh, he said, this is all the TV. They want some shots of Jamie, and they want to speak to you and Jamie about Andy. And I went, oh, no. Mm-hmm. I went, no, this is about Jamie. And it was so difficult because, of course, the referee of the tournament was so excited that there's going to be some coverage of his tournament that he's letting it all happen. And Jamie knew that they weren't there for him. They were there because they wanted a story about Andy and something with, you know, his brother. And it was, Jamie played horribly, and he lost. And he was really upset afterwards because, of course, there were reporters there, and they didn't want to speak to him about what he'd done. It was all about Andy. And that was almost like a introduction to what life is going to be like for Jamie a lot of the time. A lot of the time when he is interviewed, and it still happens, he's asked questions, more questions about Andy than he is about him. Maybe not so much now, but for many years that's how it was, and that's not an easy situation either. And I'm actually forever grateful that they do completely different disciplines of tennis to each other, and they're not in direct competition with each other. But that's not an easy situation to manage, and it's, you know, it's all about trying to help them to understand that you do your thing and you don't compare. You know, what you're trying to do is become one of the best doubles players in the world, and that's ultimately is what Jamie has done. But at that time he was still playing singles, and so the comparisons were always about what Andy's doing, what Jamie's doing. But I think once Jamie went down the doubles route, it became an easier situation.
That must have tugged on your own heartstrings as well as a mother to see that, because you're so proud of your eldest son for doing so well in his chosen career, and one that even at that stage any mother would have been incredibly proud of, and to see that overshadowed must have been quite difficult, was it?
Yeah, that's not an easy thing to watch unfolding, and to, you never know if you're handling things in the right way. But I've always tried to take a common sense approach and calm approach, and to encourage each of them as much as the other in their own respective ways, and to try to, certainly as they got older, to not see each other as direct competition. You're each other's best support network, and actually that's what they continue to be now, which is great.
You'd said that you asked the question what to do when you realise you've got exceptional children. Do you panic? Do you bury your head in the sand, or do you rise to the challenge, I guess, and get on with it? But how do you even know you've got exceptional children? I mean, I'm sure every parent thinks that their child is exceptional to some extent. How and when do you know that they truly are or could be world beaters? And did you ever have a moment of panic?
I don't think you know, when they're young, you never know what, you know, they are kids who are good at something. I mean, for Jamie, when he was a kid, you know, my kids did it pretty much every sport under the sun when they were little. And like all kids aged somewhere between 8 and 10, 11, they start to pick the things that they like themselves the best, and they'll focus on a couple of things. And for Jamie, it was golf and tennis, and he had a 3 handicap of golf, I think, when he was about 15. And for Andy, it was football and tennis. And, you know, eventually they both had to make a decision as to which way they were going to go. And, you know, Jamie made his decision after more or less when he was coming to the end of school year. And Andy made his when he was about 14 and a half. He had to choose between the two because he just couldn't physically have enough time to do both of them. But I get asked that question so many times, and I say, you know, it's the common sense thing again. You know, I have talented kids, as in they are physically gifted and they are competitive. But they are kids, and it's completely different thing to be a kid who enjoys their sport as a hobby when they're little and are good at it, to being an adolescent or an adult who is in a position to decide that they're good enough and mature enough to see their sport as a potential career and have to do it day in and day out. You know, because when you're young, you can kind of pick and choose. You can do it when you feel like it. And you do. It's completely different, and it's why now I think there is no point in putting all your eggs in one basket with only allowing a child to do one sport. Why? You know, because if that sport doesn't work out, or they end up not enjoying it for whatever reason, maybe the environment, maybe their friends stop playing, whatever it is, what are they going to do then? You know, it's that all or nothing thing is wrong. And I definitely think with both of my kids, it wasn't until they were both probably around 16 and talking about, one, they looked like they were both going to be pretty good, but they were also old enough to have had Andy had been training overseas, Jamie had been playing quite a few overseas tournaments, and he was finishing school. He was old enough to know this is what I want to do. But, you know, to say that with kids who are 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 even, it's like, you just don't know. They're just children who are good at what they do. And that's why I think the parents and the coaches that surround the kids have to take a long-term, you have to take a very long-term view. And it's not about who's the best 12-year-old. It's actually about developing the game and investing in the skills and the opportunities and the competitive experiences that will help you to survive in your sport much further down the line. Because if it is at some point going to be a career, you're unlikely to make money from a sport like tennis unless you hit the top 100. Mm-hmm. And very few people hit the top 100. So it becomes a very, very expensive exercise. So that whole thing about investing in the development, the long-term development, is crucial. And it's not, oh, he's the best under 12 in Britain, we better make sure he gets everything. Because you can end up spoiling them, and then they don't learn how to work hard and appreciate. You know, you've got to get kids to a stage where they actually love the torture almost of working hard, the torture of losing. Do you know what I mean? You've got to love it. You've got to love the journey and the pain almost. You've got to be able to do that.
Still to come in my chat with Judy Murray.
I think we all have to stick together, the women, and we have to work together, and we have to use our voices wherever we can. It's not about what I see or what I know or me telling you. It's actually, what can I tease out of you?
That's in the next episode of When Orla Met, available to download in all the usual places right now. Thanks, as ever, to the wonderful Jonathan Rowe for editing this episode. And a huge thank you to Twist Teas for not only making the most delicious teas I've tasted in years, but for sponsoring this podcast as well. If you have any thoughts on what you've heard so far, do get in touch via email, orla@whenorlamet.com. You can leave comments and follow me on Twitter and Instagram, @whenorlamet. And if you like what you hear, I would love it if you left me a review on iTunes. And don't forget to not miss out on any of the chats still to come. Please do subscribe to When Orla Met.